Welcome to the Liver Lounge, your go-to podcast for the latest updates in hepatology, featuring discussions with the world's leading experts.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest episode of this podcast that is done by the Liver Foundation. I'm Dr. Margaret Ting. I'm from Singapore, and really, really honored and privileged to have with me today Professor Chris Cotley. He's the director of the Liver Institute Northwest and professor at the Elson S. Floyd College of Medicine at the Washington State University. And he's a renowned hepatologist. He has recently, as part of a group, led a study on the efficacy and safety of elafibranor in permeability cholangitis. And this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in November 2023. So welcome, Professor Cotley, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great. And so just to kind of establish a bit of the background of this study, and also for listeners who may not be so familiar with PBC, how common is this condition globally and in the United States?
So primary biliary cholangitis is somewhere between a rare disorder and an uncommon disorder. We think there may be about 150,000 to 200,000 patients in the US. And one of the things that's interesting about PBC is it used to be thought of predominantly a condition that affected middle-aged white women. But we now know that all ethnic and racial groups can, in fact, be affected by PBC. And we have now seen a growing prevalence of PBC among populations that we thought historically were not affected. So, for example, in China, PBC is now being more and more described. And PBC is particularly common in indigenous populations in the United States, among Native Americans and Alaska Natives. PBC is probably more common than in the general population. So one myth that should be done away with is that PBC is a disorder of white women. PBC also affects men, and can affect men also of any racial or ethnic group. And this is important to consider because a lot of times the diagnosis of PBC is not entertained in men or in minority populations in the US, for example. So it's important to have an open mind about considering the diagnosis of PBC. We know it's an autoimmune disease, and like most autoimmune diseases, if not all autoimmune diseases, we think it begins with a genetic predisposition to the disease, and then one or more environmental triggers that may then manifest the disease process. And the environmental triggers are quite interesting. Chemicals, industrial chemicals, antibiotics, history of infections, hairspray, nail polish, a number of common things that are utilized by women are often putatively associated as the triggers. The other misconception about PBC is it only affects older women. We now know that although I'm not aware of PBC occurring in children, and teenagers, it can occur in very young women, as young as 18, 19 years of age. And I've seen patients as old as 80 present with their new diagnosis of PBC. So it's an uncommon disease, not quite a truly rare disease, but relatively rare compared to other liver diseases that are seen. And in fact, among women, PBC is a leading indication for liver transplantation. So that gives you an idea about the epidemiology of this condition. We know that the autoimmune manifestation of PBC is a immune-mediated attack on the small bile ducts within the liver. These are the intralobular bile ducts. generally about 80 microns in size. We do not think PBC affects the large bile ducts that are visible to the eye on cholangiograms. And in this way, PBC is different from sclerosing cholangitis, or PSC, which is a disease that affects the large bile ducts and is associated with inflammatory bowel disease. The hallmark of the diagnosis of PBC is the positive anti-mitochondrial antibody. This is a mitochondrial antigen to which antibodies are directed, and we think that the mitochondrial target is the PDCE2 pyruvate dehydrogenase complex in the mitochondria. Why an immune attack occurs to this particular antigen is not clear. But about 95% to 90% of patients with PBC will have a high titer positive anti-mitochondrial antibody. Another 2 to 3% may not have a positive AMA, but may have a positive disease-specific ANA. These are the so-called SP100 and GP210 ANAs. So in about 95 to 97% of patients, the diagnosis of PBC can be comfortably made with a cholestatic pattern of liver test abnormalities. So that is an elevated alkaline phosphatase, gamma GT, out of proportion to elevation in the aminotransferases, such as AST and ALT, with or without elevation in total bilirubin level. Bilirubin elevation, of course, is a marker of bile duct loss and more advanced disease. And when we see bilirubin levels rising in PBC, we need to be concerned that that patient may have lost sufficient numbers of bile ducts and may be on a trajectory towards being considered for liver transplantation. So in summary, PBC is a cholestatic liver disease. It has an autoimmune basis. And in the vast majority of cases, with the right clinical background and appropriate clinical suspicion, a positive AMA and or a disease-specific ANA, along with a cholestatic pattern of liver test abnormalities, is sufficient to make the diagnosis.
Thanks, Prof. That's a really wonderful introduction and a background to PBC, the condition. So I think just to go a bit deeper into PBC, what are some of the existing treatment options for PBC and their efficacy?
So we have had an established treatment for PBC since 1997-98, and that is ursodeoxycholic acid. And it is effective in PBC. And well over half of patients with PBC will have a satisfactory response to ursodeoxycholic acid. And the rationale for the use of UDCA is based on the concept that you have a immune-mediated attack on the bile ducts, and that leads to bile duct damage, and therefore results in failure to secrete bile acids into the bile duct lumen. So bile acids may leak in the liver parenchyma, and bile acids being detergents can be quite toxic to cell membranes and damage hepatocytes. And it is presumed that once you have this hepatocellular injury from bile acids, then there is a secondary immune response targeting those damaged hepatocytes that then perpetuates the injury process and then ultimately leads to fibrosis and potentially cirrhosis. So the idea of ursodeoxycholic acid is essentially to replace the bile ducts to replace the bile acids that accumulate, and the production of bile acids may actually increase in the setting of cholestasis, because there's a compensatory increase in the production of bile acids. So once you have this kind of increased sort of cranked up bile acid production, along with bile acid damage to the hepatocytes, that is a key factor in the generation of liver injury. So the concept of URSO being a more hydrophilic bile acid is to replace the toxic bile acids with URSO by increasing the concentration of URSO in the bile from about 3% in normal humans or in untreated humans to about 30 to 40%. And it is presumed that URSO deoxycholic acid may increase bile flow, may increase the pH of bile, and make the bile more aqueous, and therefore make the bile sort of less toxic, if you will. So URSO has been around for a long time, and URSO was approved showing a reduced need for liver transplantation and better liver-related outcomes in patients at high risk who were treated with URSO. URSO is less effective in patients with more advanced disease, such as those who have cirrhosis. So we really didn't have any additional second-line therapies for the remaining 40-plus percent of patients who either do not tolerate the URSO because of side effects, such as diarrhea, loose stools, abdominal pain, hair loss, or remain with elevated blood tests, such as alkaline phosphatase, despite being treated with URSO. And subsequently, a number of very important papers were published that developed models, predictive models, that show that if you look at the alkaline phosphatase level and bilirubin level 1 year after starting URSO deoxycholic acid, those who continue to have high alkaline phosphatase levels and particularly with elevated bilirubin levels, even if it's just slightly above the upper limit of normal, have a dramatically increased risk 15 years later of needing a liver transplant or having a liver-related adverse outcome. This was work that was done by the Global PBC Study Group, of which I'm one of the contributing members, as well as the UK PBC. And this is based on large data sets of patients who were monitored 1 year after starting URSO therapy. So the elevated alkaline phosphatase being persistently elevated despite adequate therapy with URSO deoxycholic acid is a harbinger of increased risk of adverse liver-related outcomes. So that provided a good platform for identifying patients who would be at higher risk. And a second-line therapy, obeticholic acid, was approved in 2016 in the United States for those patients who continue to have elevated alkaline phosphatase and or elevated bilirubin, or who did not tolerate URSO deoxycholic acid. And in about 47 to 48, roughly close to 50% of patients who were treated with obeticholic acid, there was a response, meaning that the alkaline phosphatase had at least a 15% reduction and fell to lower than 1.67 times upper limit of normal and maintained a normal bilirubin after 1 year of therapy. So obeticholic acid was approved as second-line treatment based on the surrogate endpoint of alkaline phosphatase improvement in 2016. Now, subsequently, there was a commitment to doing a what's called a confirmatory trial. So this would be a phase 4 or phase 3b confirmatory trial where the improvement in alkaline phosphatase has to be reflected in improved liver-related outcomes. So a surrogate endpoint being achieved is a pathway in the U.S. for what's called accelerated approval or conditional approval. And it's based on a surrogate endpoint that's reasonably likely to predict clinical benefit. So obeticholic acid was approved in 2016. And as I mentioned, approximately half of the patients achieved our therapeutic goal of lowering alkaline phosphatase and maintaining a normal bilirubin. Obeticholic acid, unfortunately, has some had some liabilities. First, being a bile acid, the exposures in the liver were much higher in patients with very advanced liver disease. So initially, the drug was approved for use in patients with Child-Pugh class B or C cirrhosis, which, as you know, is more advanced liver disease. And we then discovered that in these patients, even though you might be starting at much lower doses of obeticholic acid, there still was a risk of accelerated and adverse liver outcomes. Subsequently, it was discovered that there were additional patients who had cirrhosis and maybe more decompensated than we thought, who also should not receive obeticholic acid. So the approval of obeticholic acid was modified to be limited to patients who did not have clinically significant portal hypertension, such as splenomegaly or thrombocytopenia or varices, but only to compensated cirrhosis without portal hypertension or non-cirrhotic patients. Other issues with obeticholic acid is the main liability of this drug, which is a side effect of itching. Now, as you may know, patients with PBC already have itching, and two-thirds of patients with PBC at some point or another will complain of itching. So the fact that itching was a side effect of obeticholic acid made it less attractive. Now, we have mitigation strategies for managing the itching, starting at a low dose and titrating up, which results in accommodation. And we also have ways to mitigate the pruritus while the patient is accommodating to the obeticholic acid. Obeticholic acid also had a somewhat unfavorable effect on lipids, which is a low HDL and a higher LDL, although these, in my opinion, are not clinically relevant for the PBC population, where risk of major adverse cardiovascular events is not really that high compared to other populations. So in summary, obeticholic acid was an important advance. We continue to use it in our clinics. And there are data suggesting, based on real-world cohorts and external controls, that in fact, obeticholic acid appears to have reduced the need for liver transplantation or liver-related death in patients who receive it as second-line treatment. The confirmatory trial to show that improvement in alkaline phosphatase with obeticholic acid resulted in improvement in long-term outcomes was not successful because there were not enough events in the groups to show a difference between treated versus placebo. Part of this was due to something that we call functional unblinding, where we know that since patients were able to go and get their alkaline phosphatase levels measured outside of the study, they may have been incentivized to leave the study if they had not shown a reduction in their alkaline phosphatase, and therefore they may have surmised that they were on placebo and left the study. So these are some challenges that we won't get into much more, but ultimately the data with obeticholic acid does show, based on a variety of different databases and data sources, that it does appear to have shown benefit, in my opinion, compared to before it was available, in reducing the burden of liver disease. But because of these liabilities and because of the fact that only about 40% of patients respond to obeticholic acid, 40 to 50%, there's a need for additional therapies. And that sets the stage for elafibranor and other medications that are currently in development. You've asked me to comment on the elafibranor trial, so I'm going to say a few words about that. So this was a phase 3 trial based on a phase 2 trial showing that elafibranor did result in improved alkaline phosphatase. And elafibranor, similar to other drugs that are being developed for second-line treatment of PBC, is a PPAR agonist. And PPARs are hormone receptors that have a variety of different effects once they are activated by ligands. And there's PPAR alpha, delta, and gamma. PPAR gamma agonists, of course, were known for quite some time. They were used to develop therapies for diabetes. and are currently being studied for non-alcoholic steatohepatitis or metabolic associated steatohepatitis, as it's called now. And PPAR alpha and delta appear to have anti-inflammatory and anti-fibrotic properties. Furthermore, one nice benefit of these agents is that instead of worsening pruritus, they appear to improve pruritus or itching and appear to have a favorable effect on lipids. In fact, non-specific PPAR agonists, also called fibrates, such as fenofibrate and bezafibrate, have been around for a long time. Bezafibrate, not available in the US, but is available in Canada, Asia, Europe. Fenofibrate is a fibrate that's available in the US. And these drugs have been around for a long time to treat dyslipidemia, often associated with diabetes. So elafibranor is a PPAR alpha delta dual agonist. And in this study, patients were randomized to receive either 80 milligrams of elafibranor or placebo. And the primary outcome was the same as the obeticholic acid trial, so-called POISE criteria, named for the POISE study, which is a improvement in alkaline phosphatase to less than 1.67 times upper limit of normal, maintaining a normal bilirubin, and at least a 15% reduction. And elafibranor met the primary endpoint with a 4% placebo response and a 51% response in the elafibranor treated group, and a subset of patients actually normalized alkaline phosphatase. Although there was no statistically significant difference in itching improvement using the NRS scale for itching, which is widely used in the US as a validated pruritus endpoint, there were some secondary endpoints that suggested that there may be a favorable effect on itching and itching-related quality of life. The main side effects of elafibranor are potential risk for some drug-induced liver injury, which was not seen in a concerning number of patients. So the drug is safe from that perspective with regard to drug-induced liver injury. And all fibrates have a risk of muscle injury, and especially in patients who are receiving concomitant statins. So overall, the safety profile of elafibranor was acceptable, and the benefit in terms of improvement in alkaline phosphatase seemed to be superior to any concern about risks. And this appears to be a major advance in treating PBC. There are other agents that are also currently in development that have similar types of mechanisms, and I'm sure you'll be discussing them at another time, and I would be happy to come back and talk about them with you.
Thanks a lot, Prof. Cotley. That was a really great kind of summary on the treatment options available for PBC and also on elafibranor. Now, Prof, I just wanted to ask, I noticed that as part of the exclusion criteria, I think patients with advanced liver disease or decompensated liver disease were also excluded from this trial. And in this group of patients, if they fail to respond to UDCA, what would your suggested management options be for them?
Yeah, so this is a challenging population of patients. And unfortunately, we do see these patients not infrequently in clinic. And one of the points that I should have mentioned earlier is, although ursodeoxycholic acid has been a major advance, and since it's been around for a couple of decades now, we have the ability to change the natural history of liver disease for patients with PBC. But there's a subset of patients, typically younger patients, who have rapidly progressive disease. And if you look at the average age at transplant, it has not changed. in the year since IRSA was introduced, even though the overall number of liver transplants has decreased. So for that subset of patients with rapidly progressive disease and the subset of patients who have advanced decompensated disease, liver transplant remains the only option. One of the concerns with obeticholic acid, pan-PPAR, fibrates, and PPAR agonists is their safety in advanced liver disease has not been established. So we need studies identifying patients who have PBC, who may be candidates for therapy while they're awaiting liver transplantation. But we need to make sure that we have the correct dose, and we need to make sure that we first and foremost are focusing on liver safety. So for that subset of patients with very advanced liver disease, we continue to have significant challenges in providing them treatment options, and liver transplant remains the only real option for these patients. There are some other therapies being developed that may have lower concern for any liver safety issues. We are actually looking at subsets of patients to be treated with these new agents who have more advanced disease with careful monitoring. And I think the take-home message is early diagnosis, so that we can identify patients sooner and get them started on these therapies, especially because our goal of treatment is now evolving. And instead of just lowering the alkaline phosphatase below some threshold, we want to actually normalize all these tests. And that would mean probably multiple combinations, two or three different combinations of drugs that work by different mechanisms. So no clear therapeutic option with pharmacotherapy for advanced decompensated liver disease at the present time. And I think it just reinforces why your listeners and your audience and practitioners need to think about PBC early, make the diagnosis early.
Just a few more questions, I think, on the treatment, second line treatment of PBC. So I think you mentioned that in patients with on fibrates or on, you know, elafibranor, obeticholic acid, there's some increased risk of muscle injury. And I think in your paper, you did mention that there was a patient who had severe rhabdomyolysis because they had advanced liver disease as well and was on statin. So in this group of patients, would you recommend to like hold off the statin while starting the treatment? Is that something you recommend practically?
Right. I think that it's important. What we learned from these from this patient is that recognition of patients with advanced liver disease, and especially those who have or are at risk for clinically significant portal hypertension, is really important before starting any therapy. And this patient also was on statins at probably at a dose that was higher than what they should have received. So I think it's important with this entire class to review the statin dose and consider reducing it or holding it. And second, be really careful and meticulous about evaluating the patient's liver stiffness by elastography, synthetic function, and any signs of portal hypertension. And you would probably want to be cautious about starting these therapies in those patients.
Thanks for these great tips. And probably just a final question for you, Prof. Courtney. Do you think that elafibranor is... Now it looks like there are some advantages of elafibranor over obeticholic acid. Do you think that it will eventually become an established or preferred second line treatment option for PBC, or what do you think is the space looking like for patients who fail also the deoxycholic acid?
Yeah, it's a good question. Obviously, it's as Yogi Berra said, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future, and so it's hard to know how the various drugs that are being developed are going to find their place in the clinic. Certainly, I would say elafibranor has some obvious advantages compared to obeticholic acid, but obeticholic acid has also been around for 8 years now And we have a lot of data suggesting that it may really change the natural history of PBC in a positive way. So I think there will be patients for whom obeticholic acid is a great second line option, those without any concern about cardiovascular concerns, those without any lipid concerns, and those who don't have pruritus. For patients who already have significant pruritus, I could see starting with a drug like elafibranor or one of the other PPAR agonists when they get approved as a preferred second line therapy. And I think at the end of the day, you know, if I had a crystal ball, I would say we're probably moving to combinations where we would use both NFXR agonists as well as a PPAR agonist, which work in non-overlapping mechanisms to achieve that biochemical remission.
Thanks a lot, Prof. Really thank you for, you know, taking the time to share your wealth of knowledge and expertise in this subject area. Thanks everyone else for listening in to the latest podcast by the Liver Foundation. And we would like to also really thank Prof. Cowley for being here with us and sharing his time so generously with us. Thank you, Prof. Cowley.
Thank you.
We have come to the end of the episode. Thank you for joining us and stay tuned for more captivating discussions.